Welcome to Blacksiders, the no-holds-barred conversation about news and current affairs that we feel like talking about. I'm Gemma McKinnon.
And I'm Peter McGillivray.
Welcome, Pete. How are you going? How's things been?
I can't believe that we are so far into the year. We have started this year sprinting, and I am a little bit breathless, I have to say. There is a lot going on all of the time, but I really love Blacksiders. This is our little show that we have on 2SER is bringing me a great deal of joy.
I agree. If you don't like your regular life, go into a fantasy world where you can run the show.
Venture into community radio.
100%. If you've got an idea, give us a bell.
And I think, you know, I really feel that it's been such a great way to be creative and to share the things that we know and think and feel, especially in our lives as Black women in the world today. And it's just great to share that with our listeners who are becoming our radio family.
Speaking of the year running away, winter is coming and I have stocked up on firewood.
You've found a firewood supplier.
Got a fire guy, got a wood guy.
Woody.
Got a chicken man, got a wood guy. So our woodshed is stocked up.
Wow.
I'm preparing for the winter.
Like a real mountain gal.
Oh, no, I'm really excited.
And are you still getting those kind of comments from people like, oh, wait till winter, that's when you're truly tested?
Apparently you have to make it through two winters.
Oh, really? People actually leave. They don't survive.
No, that's 100% it. But then once you've made it through two winters, apparently then it's water off a duck's back. You'll be wearing T-shirts in 5 degrees.
Yeah, shorts and thongs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then your kids will be just chasing the cold wherever they go, except there won't be anywhere left because the planet will be cooking.
Dead.
Oh, we're so dark.
And on that note, last week we were talking about sometimes feeling like a bad black fella, and it got me thinking about a topic that I think is simultaneously mob's favourite and most hated topic of conversation, and that is identity politics.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually go so far as to say that it's not just a subject that every black fella has an opinion on, but that at one time or another, that they themselves have then contradicted that opinion. Like, it's such a huge part of our lives, of our community, and I don't think that anybody has it right. So yeah. With that in mind, this complicated, amorphous thing, I think we're going to try to unpack it a bit tonight. And the reason is that I think it is a bit of an elephant in the room. Everybody talks about it within their own little circles. But I don't know how much of it is playing out in the mainstream, in a sort of broader society. I don't know if non-First Nations folk really know that this is a thing. Like, what would be your best explainer to the person on the Clapham omnibus of what are we talking about when we're talking about identity politics in this context?
I mean, when I think about it, I think about it as if, when I think about how external audiences are contending with it, it's the understanding of, or the fraught nature of, collective identity given the history of colonization and intervention into Aboriginal people's lives and into Torres Strait Islander people's lives since white people arrived here. And Indigenous peoples in Australia and globally have been trying to take back power to identify and organise and say, this is who we are and this is how we determine who we are related to each other. And in a context like Australia, where the state historically has had responsibility or taken responsibility for identifying whether you're Aboriginal or not, then that creates this precedent where the expectation is that other people get to have a say, or that that's relevant, other people being non-Indigenous people. So I see identity politics as being something which is led not by us, but by bad faith actors outside of our own communities. The conversation about identity and connection and belonging that happens within our communities is something which I don't think there's a great deal of understanding at all. But I think that we have our own version of bad faith actors who like to police people's identities. And I think that comes from a place of deep insecurity about their own identity.
Absolutely. Like I see people's insecurities around whether or not they feel legitimate as a blackfella, whether or not they meet the required definition of a blackfella, as being something that has been, I guess, created by non-Indigenous people, and is, let's be honest, it still is perpetrated by non-Indigenous people, but feels to me as something that is maybe more rife within the community in terms of it being perpetrated laterally,
yeah,
rather than from non-Indigenous people.
I think that's correct, but I want to be really clear that the source of the conflict is with non-Indigenous people. That's where it comes from.
Absolutely.
So
yep.
The symptom of the lateral violence within our community and amongst our peers is because we have to constantly assert ourselves and our identities and explain why that's important as a defence against ongoing attacks on us.
Do you think that partly, I think we've spoken about this before, but one of the positive things I think that has been sort of emerging or making a re-emergence in recent years has been, you know, a sort of rejection of pan-Aboriginality and this focus more on what your First Nation is, where your mob is from, and recognizing the diversity of culture within Aboriginal Australia. That has kind of been a bit of a double-edged sword, in my opinion, because I think what you then find is more conflict between us amongst ourselves, because of, you know, a lack of compassion, I guess, or recognition of the varied impacts of colonization on each of those First Nations.
Correct. So I think on that I would say one of the things that's really disappointing about the lateral violence in our community against people asserting their identity who have been descendants of members of the Stolen Generations, they are people who are Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander, but because of these interventions into our lives and communities and bloodlines, people are reconnecting with their histories. The disinterest in people to take responsibility for our own people in caring for and nurturing and helping people come back home to their families and communities and their culture and their identities is so disappointing and distressing to me. And I think that I would say you know, the really awful treatment of our own people by people who seem to think it's okay to, you know, compete over crumbs. And it comes down to that, right? This is a, you know, this is a, comes from a deficit mindset. There's only so much that's available. We need to exclude people who don't deserve it. So it comes down to this kind of deserving, undeserving rhetoric, which is straight out of the right-wing playbook and conservative politics playbook. So I think the one of the things that I, going to your point about pan-Aboriginality, you know, I identify as Kalkatungu. That's because our family has been able to do that really important work with my grandmother to connect and take her home, for her to have that opportunity to reconnect with her country and her relatives and her families after being taken as a little girl. Over many, many years, that was almost two decades of work that our family did. That doesn't mean that our family erases the reality of Nan's experience of being taken from her country, because that had real impacts for our family. That's how we ended up on Darumbal country. And so the work that happened...
That's right. I think there, perhaps where we need to be looking at that continued connection to country to and to community as actually a really special and lucky experience, as opposed to the base level of connection that you need to have, of understanding that you need to have in order to identify as a First Nations person and feel proud to be a First Nations person.
Yeah.
That it's not enough. It seems like these days it's not enough to be an Aboriginal person. It's not enough to be a Blackfella. You have to be, you know, able to trace your family lineage back generations and generations and be able to show your connection to particular parts of the country. But having those standards, despite knowing all that we know about the dispossession that's occurred in very recent times, is puts people in a really difficult place.
It does, and it completely... There's two things that I would say about that. The first is that I do believe that there is work that legitimate community building, nation building, leadership work that must be done by community leaders in whatever way that community wants to appoint them, based upon factors such as connection to community, lines of bloodlines and family groups and those types of factors. I think that's fair and legitimate. What I don't agree with is the idea that you can't work in Aboriginal affairs or be proud in your identity and the work that you do, the way that you move in the world, the way that you live and breathe and just be, that somehow you need to, you know, pull out your family tree in order just to live black. That's absurd to me.
And the experience of one person doesn't take away from the experience of another, right?
Yeah.
Nobody is sort of suggesting that by, you know, giving people that may not have the level of connection that they would like to have a space within our community and a sense of belonging within our community, that doesn't take away from the, you know, immense level of respect that we have for those people that do hold cultural knowledge and cultural authority.
Absolutely. And I think this is where we as a community of peers need to get way more sophisticated in recognizing A, how much work there is still left to do, and we are not in a position to be turning people away who are prepared to stand up and do that work that we need.
Yeah, we need the numbers.
Yeah.
And let's talk a bit about colorism and about, I guess, our experiences, the experiences of people that we know. I guess this is something that was introduced to me a lot later in life, I think. I didn't really come to explore or understand the complexities of identity, of First Nations identity, until I went to university and met other First Nations people from all over the country. I'd never really realized that there was these sort of complex relationships. I'd never really considered the journey that people go on and how impactful that can be on people, how emotional that can be for people. From my perspective, I'd always just been me, you know. I'd always sort of known who I was, where I'd come from. I grew up with like mostly with my white family in a white neighborhood. It never crossed my mind that that experience was any less Aboriginal than anybody else's. But then, of course, we went to university and then started meeting, a lot more people and hearing a lot of different opinions. What has been your experience in dealing with not just colorism, because I think colorism is a big factor in this, but also, and I don't know what you call it, but I feel like there is this sense that around socioeconomic factors, if you didn't grow up poor, then you're not as black as the next person.
Yeah.
What was your experience of that?
Yeah, so I had a really diverse education, which I think left me feeling very confused by my interactions with white people in my schooling experience. So I went to an Aboriginal preschool with my cousins and all of the other Aboriginal kids and Torres Strait Islander kids and South Sea Islander kids in our community. And then I went to, for all of my childhood up until I went to primary school, I just saw Aboriginal kids. And so then when I went to primary school in Canberra, because my mum was in the Commonwealth Public Service, so we did a little stint in Canberra, and I was one of only a handful of Aboriginal kids in the school. But I was just like, okay, so there's different kids here. I didn't really have any sense of myself being different. We were just kids. And then in high school, back in Rocky, I was the only Aboriginal kid in the school. Every other kid was white. So that's when I felt it big time, because not only were these kids, all boarding school students, so they all were from pastoral stations and cattle stations and things like that. So they were really racist and awful, and I had lots of nemesis, and I used to get into a lot of fights. And then it wasn't until I was kind of in my last couple of years of high school that I had some teachers kind of recognize that I had academic potential, I think is what they call it, and things started to change for me. But I had the safety and protection of my family that I'd go home to every day. So school was just kind of this place that I went and had to do. But otherwise, I was, that was the other. School was the other. At home was when I was, just me.
And then coming to university, do you think that people,
What I experienced in university was for the first time realizing that people were relying entirely on stereotypes of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people as their frame of reference for me. So I would get a lot of, confusion because, oh, hang on, you're in law school. I didn't think Aboriginal people even finished school. Or, hey, you're here. How did that happen? Aren't all Aboriginal people in Central Australia or like locked up or like, what are you actually doing here? It was that kind of confusion. And that confusion has followed me my entire career. Even when I was a practicing solicitor, where I had lawyers who I worked with in the profession, who I truly believe didn't even know how to talk to me or relate to me because I was an Aboriginal person at the bar table with them and not behind the Perspex glass.
Oh, yeah. That, like, I mean, the amount of lawyers that I've heard tell that story of being behind the bar table and the judge and the other lawyers the assuming that they're the accused.
That they're the client.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's zoom in a bit on this colorism piece. How do you see it playing out in the First Nations community? And do you think, you know, despite the cups of tea analogies and, you know, I really sort of felt that it made sense to me from a sort of logical perspective, but I also felt that through university, it was really sort of drilled into us that the color of your skin does not define your Aboriginality. It doesn't define your connection to culture. Do you think that that carried over? Do you think that that sunk in for people?
I think that that's a private matter that people who are having a reckoning with their identity and are making sense of that for themselves in the context of their families and their own family histories. Because publicly, when we're having to deal with the external world, we have to face the reality that those of us with fair skin will be coded as white or coded as something that's not Aboriginal. And the privileges that come with that, because we know that the unconscious biases in favour of people with fairer skin results in real racism and consequences with people who have brown skin and who are identified as being Aboriginal. And what we also know, though, is that racism, even if you have fair skin, you will still, because of the institutional racism, still be subject to negative consequences because you identify as Aboriginal.
I'm not going to pose as a question. I'll just say what I think. One of the frustrations I think that I have experienced, and I think that other people within the community experience, and that often then leads to or manifests itself in lateral violence, is the lack of self-awareness or the lack of ownership that white passing blackfellas have of the privilege that exists there.
Correct. And that is the point that lots of, I would say high-profile Aboriginal leaders who identify as public intellectuals and, you know, influencers, that's the point that they're trying to make, which is that, you know, have some self-awareness about the fact that you have lots of privilege that comes from being white passing. And over a lifetime, that privilege accumulates into opportunities and being treated more favourably. And that is true. That is true of my lived experience, and that's why it's really important that we are always acting, that sometimes we aren't the right people to be doing stuff.
And yeah.
That's a controversial idea, but sometimes we're not. You have to be stepping back.
That's 100% on the money, in my opinion. I think that being a First Nations person alone doesn't give you the authority to then speak to a range yes. of issues that First Nations people face.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily speak with the same level of authority on racism as your darker skinned mate will.
Absolutely. And that's what I was getting at earlier with the idea that it goes both ways, that, you know, people, mob with fair skin shouldn't be precluded from speaking on issues which goes directly to their lived experience or their expertise or their knowledge or whatever it might be. Good ways that people who, you know, are best placed to talk about racism, I think that's an excellent example. Yeah, that's what we need. And the practice of, like, talking to one another to work that out.
Let's turn briefly to our fave, social media.
Mm-hmm.
I guess social media is a platform that I have seen the absolute worst of identity politics, of lateral violence manifest itself. Do you think that there's been, I honestly was trying to think of something, but do you see any positive aspects of that social media has brought to these sorts of conversations?
I think one of the really positive things is seeing the representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in all of their beauty and joy and gloriousness. Artists, musicians, academics, activists, you know, just mums and dads and posting some photos of, you know, their kids, their lives, and that sense of community and the, you know, the wonderful diversity of us, that's really positive. That I am really always really encouraged and, you know, optimistic, as unfashionable as that is. When I see that online, it makes me, especially young people, we have a beautiful, you know, rainbow of a community. Lots of my nieces and nephews at home here in Sydney. You know, I think that diversity is wonderful.
I think we definitely need to see more of that positivity. You're listening to Blacksiders on 2SER, and we've just had another fantastic conversation about our mob and how great we are. Let's turn to our favourite subject of the week.
An audience favourite.
Thumbs up, thumbs down. Now, where do we start? We start down.
We're starting down.
Pete, hit us with your thumbs down for the week.
Okay, so I've got a $20 note to put into the petty cash jar for my thumbs down this week. Oh, might get cancelled. Beach weddings, thumbs down. I'm just still absolutely, I mean, I get people having beach weddings circa, you know, 2006 to as late as 2013. But the fact that there are still beach weddings happening in 2024 just blows my mind. It's so impractical. Like, do you shoes on, shoes off? What do you wear? It's so hot. Like, can you bring your own tent? Like, can you have a beach gazebo? Is that kosher?
The thing about the beach is it's always windy there, right? So you've also got to navigate the lighting situation of, like, where is the sun, but also which way is the wind blowing so that my hair is blowing back,
mm-hmm.
not into my face. Like, people spend a lot of money, thousands and thousands of dollars on photos. They spend, people, guests at weddings, poor bridesmaids, please, you know, I don't think we give enough sympathy to bridesmaids, but they spend thousands of dollars on weddings, and then you're like, let's go walk in the sand.
Can I put a caveat around this one? We're talking like Australian East Coast beaches, like not a destination wedding, palms, cool flat waters where it's, you know, just a casual
stroll. No, we're talking like Maroubra.
Yeah, we're talking big ass long golden beaches where there is no shade. Just windy sand whipping in your face, sandblasting your face. Thumbs down.
Boo.
Boo.
My thumbs down is unreasonable cancellation policies. I feel like these made a big entrance during COVID because we all had to book and they had lots of rules about how many people could be in a space, yada, yada, yada. Although I also found it very interesting that they came up during a time when if you got sick and it was, you know, hugely likely that you could get sick, that you literally weren't allowed to leave your house.
Yeah.
So didn't like any of that. But a lot of those cancellation policies have held over now into, well, do we call it post-COVID years? I'm I'm doing. I'm calling it post-COVID years. But there is a particular restaurant in the Inner West that I did not, I refused to go to despite the rave reviews of how delicious the food is, because they have a 48-hour cancellation policy. And if you cancel within 48 hours, you have to pay, I think it's either $80 or $100 per person that the booking was for.
Oh my goodness.
And I just am not in a position to risk that, to be honest.
Yeah, who is?
Like, plans change. People get sick.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do? Hairdressers do it as well. And I just think that most of the time when I talk to people, they say it's not something that they enforce and that it's really just for no shows. I mean, who's that rude? Just be a no-show in this day and age. But if you're enforcing these cancellation policies, I think that's a bit rude.
I agree. If you want customer return, yeah, I agree.
I mean, even the amount of money, because we went to a wedding recently, and I was booking for a brunch in a country town in New South Wales. I won't mention it, but they have a lot of wine. And booking the brunch, I had to pay, what was it? It was like $60 per person just to book the table for brunch.
I wish people could see my face right now because I'm gooped.
I thought it Shocked was outrageous.
Face. Yeah, that is outrageous.
Good brunch, but brunch nonetheless.
Yeah, it's like not even a full meal.
It wasn't like a degustation brunch, although someone invent that, please. Degustation brunch.
That's a really good idea. Let's get some feedback from our listeners on that one.
What's the worst cancellation policy you've seen? I want to know about it.
Oh, yeah, let us know.
Thumbs up for this week, Pete.
So, just this serves as also a little update on my efforts to prioritize my health this year. But my thumbs up is non-alcoholic beverages and the excellent diversity of options that are hitting the market.
Wow.
I know. And
that's controversial.
It is controversial. I'm not going as far to say that I'm buying non-alcoholic wine, but just...
That is expensive.
Is it?
Oh my God. Yes.
Maybe we'll get sponsored.
I don't want to say anything, but there's an establishment across the road from this studio where you can buy non-alcoholic wine, and it costs like $45 a bottle.
What? That's a bit much. See, here's the thing.
I'm sorry, I'm putting a downer on your up.
Yeah, no, it's thumbs up. Sorry. Now, yes, I'm not talking about the non-alcoholic wine. We need to find a better name for it. Non-alco? Alco-free. Oh, anyway. We'll workshop that. But it's really good option because you can, if you only want to have a few drinks or a couple of drinks, you can alternate. So it's just a fun way of being able to, you know, have a couple of drinks for, you know, the joy of enjoying a drink, but also mixing it up and avoiding the hangover. Priority goal implemented.
Love it. Love it. My thumbs up is somewhat related, actually. And it's a real about face for me.
Ah.
Because previously I have been a bit of a downer on adults having hobbies. I could never really understood it. I never really got, you know, the macrame or macrame.
I
don't know what the correct pronunciation is. Or
quilting?
Quilting, I don't know if that's crocheting, definitely huge. Never really understood why, particularly young people, like people in their 20s, were suddenly taking up hobbies that I considered to be things that you would do in your retirement. I felt like if you're doing all of this in your, like now, what are you going to do when you retire? You're going to be bored. your house is going to be full of macrame and woven things, and you're just going to, I don't know, watch TV or something. But I have recently been trying to find activities to do for non-drinking people, non-party people.
Mm-hmm. Middle-aged people.
And I also am a big fan of sitting around watching crap TV. And so I've been watching shows like The Great Pottery Throwdown and The Great British Sewing Bee.
Oh, cool.
And watching these people, adults, just get really into, oh, another one I love, Forged in Fire, people making knives, people blowing glass, all these things where people are sort of doing crafty, cool things, and I'm actually leaning into it, and I'm actually thinking,
beautiful,
this is something that you can do to pass the time that doesn't involve like cleaning and boring, like life admin, but also doesn't involve getting shitters.
And you've got the space. So are we seeing the era of Gemma the crafter?
Well, so the other thing, though, I must say about the crafting is it does involve cost. Mm. So I'm thinking about maybe an activity, but okay, it's that thing, right? It's not just the cost, but you're like, if I pay this money, what if I do it once and I hate it?
You know what you should do? You can do the classes where you go have a go. That's a good gift idea for your birthday that's coming up.
There you go. There you go.
Just do some, get you some classes. You can have a little test, see if you like it, and then...
You never know, folks.
Yeah, all
right. Might be making Black Ciders mugs.
Can you please send through ideas for Gem for that? In the mountains, please.
Yes.
Blue Mountains region.
Yeah, I don't want to have to go far.
Nepean Blue Mountains catchment area.
I could go to Lithgow.
So. Yeah, Lithgow or Penrith.
Yeah.
There's options.
Thanks, everybody. I'm looking forward to our conversation next week.
Me too.
Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone. Night, Gem.